I promised to start to talk about this risk-based remediation of contaminated environment, and I have now material for two lectures, and one is basics of risk assessment, and one is the application of risk-based remediation. And I have been now thinking which one I should take first. Should I take the theory, or should I take the application? And I chose this presentation. Okay. I have included a couple of reports. If you read those reports written by very much Jussi Reinikainen, those are covering all these material. And if you go to the LaGreca waste management engineering, so it even contains more and more detailed information about this issue. And today I'm going to talk about this health-based risk assessment of contaminated soil. First, what is risk? And why to manage it? And then the connection of the soil remediation to the risk assessment. And I am teaching you everything which is based on health-based risk assessment, human health. I will download another book of Ministry of Environmental Health, which covers the ecotoxicological based remediation of environment. So those one who want to learn more about this can read that the document, but my own area is this human health. This is the one slide that I always take in the very beginning when I start to teach risk assessment or risk communication. And there are several definitions for this risk, but it always have these aspects of probability, of suffering of harm from a hazard, and in our case, we have some contaminated area, and then we have a pathway, and then we have a receptor, which is in this case this is a human being, and probability can be something what is measured, or a risk that what can be measured is it can be economical risk, it can be technological risk, but today and in my lectures, I will talk about the risk of something hazardous event for the human being, some non-carcinogenic or carcinogenic endpoint of exposure. So I think you more or less know these definitions, like toxicity. It's a potential of material to produce injury of biological system, and it's expressed like a lethal dose 50, effective dose 50, lethal concentration 50. And you can find them from the data sources. I will introduce you place where you can find those compound, those values. In some cases, there exist these values for the human being because, for example, there are some industrial accidents or epidemiological study or something like that, that one can get actually like data from human study or with access to the dose or concentration that kills or affects half of the population. But most of these values are produced from the animal tests, usually rats. And then there is some process of estimation and assessing the concentration of some compound X for 1 kilogram of animal with a positive effect. Hazard is a nature of adverse effect posed to the toxic material. And then risk is the combined probability of the suffering, the harm of loss under specific circumstances and has a magnitude. And in our case, we are talking about health risk, lifetime risk of death, or lifetime risk of some other adverse effect. Just cancer have a lifetime risk. Non-cancer risk is not for the lifetime, but for that moment. Okay, and what we want to do, we want to reduce the risk, in our case, the prevention takes place by these environmental remediation techniques. But again, here the prevention is better than removal or remediation. And also, when we do this environmental remediation, we always have a limited resources, too little money, too little resources. We have to allocate the resources to the most serious problem. So as I mentioned that, for example, Finnish government has a soil remediation fund, but it can't afford to give money for all of the applications and proposals. So it has to pick the most serious cases and use the money in order to get the maximum amount of the risk reduction. In order to have the real risk, we have the chain of this that we have to have a source. And then we have the pathway, and then we have this receptor. And if one is lacking, there is no actual risk at all. In the vocabulary of the definition, there is this as slow as reasonable, because if you have a huge amount of resource, you could solve everything, but you should start to risk control of the worst risk to the level which is tolerable. And this line, what is tolerable enough? What is acceptable enough? What is clean enough? This is the basis of the determination of the guideline values. So where this acceptable level comes from? So this is the principle. So whenever you have a contaminated sites, you have to identify the source, the place, the compound. You have to identify the pathway. Is it the drinking water inhalation, soil ingestion, and then the target? Target, is it you? Is it workers? Is it like people living in that area? But anyway, this is the concept. And based on this approach, you can start to do this risk assessment, which has these different steps. It starts with the hazard identification in that very spot. And then comes the exposure assessment, a risk estimation and risk characterization. It can be very robust. It can be based on just one sample, just one assumption, and it can be done by just normal computer for one chemical. Or it can be very sophisticated, and it can use different kind of computer models to calculate the risk. And nowadays, for example, this probabilistic risk assessment is quite commonly used in order to calculate the risk, because there exists that kind of commercial and free programs which do this risk calculation. But it all starts from the problem formulation. Okay, this is in Finnish. Yeah. This is for our Finnish students in order to be able to match the right words. So hazard identification, is there any risk? Exposure scenario, and those response assessment, risk estimation, comparing the actual calculated value for what you have calculated by yourself. And then you take some toxicological value from the database and you compare whether it is more or less that is acceptable. And in the very end, then it comes this that whether this risk is acceptable or not, and for which target group, and that is something like this risk characterization includes also sociological and ecological and political aspects. Okay, when you have your probable contaminated site, you should start to dig the information, the history of the site, what kind of industry, what kind of chemicals there has been, and very often, for example, the only source of the information has been interview of the old workers. I remember so many times the only source to identify where the hazardous waste has been disposed is to ask the workers who has been actually working in the 50s and 60s that where on earth all this hazardous matter was disposed. Oh yes, we were, well, we put it to that lake, you know, no paper, no data. And sometimes it's some like old maps, or you compare something like aerial photos, old ones, that you can see that, hello, 50 years ago in the map in this very place, there was something which looks like a soil infiltration lagoon. So it's sometimes it's like you are a detective and doing some very, very exotic way. Because before you go to the measuring the actual concentration in the environment, you really have to collect some money. And it costs. And the digging the hole or drilling the hole or hiring a truck to dig the sample from the different depths. It's very, very, very challenging, and I am going to talk more about this minimum amount of the samples or information, what is enough to do the risk assessment. Usually, whenever you do this actual measurement of the contamination of, let's say, soil, you have to choose whether you want to find hotspot, or would you be interested on the like the average concentration in that area. And then if you want to do the risk assessment based on the worst case scenario, which is usually done, then you choose the highest and maximum concentration of the contaminant in the media, what can be soil, vegetable, drinking water. Or then more probable is that take that value, this average value of the concentration. And more samples you can afford, more reliable your calculation is going to be. Usually or sometimes the contaminant is in the very initial place where it has been disposed. But what happens in reality is that, for example, all those water-soluble compounds are flushed by the rainwater. And those compounds, they will reach the groundwater. And groundwater is flowing with different speeds and reach the place, for example, like drinking water abstraction well. And sometimes, for example, if you choose a compound which is a hydrophobic, like dioxins and furans, they are so hydrophobic that they will stick to the organic matter on the very surface of the soil, and they won't travel. Sometimes your compound X is volatile, and what you have to consider is the exposure of the, let's say, evaporation of compound X from the soil to the house and the indoor air of the building, what is about the contaminated area. Then you have to recognize the potentially affected population and biota, and then also how many people, how long, how often. So you can do that. You can do that with very, very robust way, or then you can do very sophisticated measuring using computer models of the transport of the pollutant X in the different kind of soil matrix about the groundwater and under the groundwater level. And yes. And as far as I know, some of you have already been working with this kind of problems. How to actually to identify where this hazardous contaminant, what is originating from the, let's say, like old sawmill site, where on earth these chlorinated phenols are at the very moment when they will reach this Bursiala drinking water abstraction or artificial groundwater abstraction area. And what is the concentration at the moment? And also, if you have a spill now, if it's like a diesel or of gasoline, and you should be able to estimate how soon this bloom is going to reach the sensitive exposure point. And but there are some rule of thumbs, for example, that for example, firefighters in Finland, when they are dealing with the leakage of the diesel or gasoline accident by the road, so on average, the groundwater in Finland is in the depth of 2 meters. So these firefighters has about 2 hours to reach the leakage and collect and absorb the material before this hydrocarbon reaches the groundwater. And when it's reached the groundwater, everything becomes much, much more expensive. And then you have to choose the scenario. You can calculate the worker scenario. Either the workers are there just during the remediation, or are the people going to work there 5 days per week and 8 hours per day? That is one criteria of risk assessment. Then there is a trespasser scenario, that the people occasionally pass the area and inhale or eat or drink the water just once, and that's all. The most severe and worst case scenario comes from the residential use scenario, because this includes all kind of activities what the people are practicing. Starting that they might live there most of their life, 60 years, and they will spend most of the time there, and they are exposed with the drinking water and soil and inhalation simultaneously. And when the very worst case scenario is calculated, then this kind of residential use scenario is selected with one assumption, that there are children, and the children is playing outdoors every day and eating some amount of the soil. And that gives to the peak the highest possible risk what exists, can exist in the normal risk assessment. Of course, it gives you overestimation of the risk, but if you don't want to buy this risk, then you have to do the more sophisticated calculation and start to exclude the children and change all the variables which are components in the risk assessment. And you can do that with this kind of risk-based techniques by using this different kind of technique like crystal ball, which gives you hundreds and hundreds of different kind of variation, where all the parameters varies from 0 to 100%. Yeah. Recreational scenario is something like less severe. It's almost like industrial area or parking area. So the people are not supposed to spend so much time there, and they are not supposed to be exposed for example to the eating of the soil. And then comes the construction scenario, which is related also for the exposure of the workers and people who are passing of the site. For example, if you go to Nuuskakuja, which is one remediation case in close to the campus. So last fall, when I was there, the smell of gasoline and solvents what was very, very strong if you were just passing this site. And if you are able to smell something, it means that you are exposed, because your nose is your nose is quite unsensitive, and if you can smell something, you are exposed already. Like if you can smell smoke coming from the wooden stove, it means that you are exposed to the fine particle matters, and the risk is quite significant already if you're able to smell it. Which brings to my mind one of the most weird, funny masteral theses what I have ever supervised was this: the use of a dog to try to find the contamination of the chlorinated phenols. And this dog was an old police dog, retired from the drug sniffing drugs and things like that. So one old retired police with this retired dog, they started to practice to smell chlorinated phenol, and the dog Topi was excellent. He was able to sniff the chlorinated phenol from the standardized test, which is used for the this kind of drug tests or money or whatever. So almost like under the concentration of what can be measured by sophisticated instruments. But when we took Topi to the actual site of old sawmill, it was so difficult because it was totally contaminated. It was several hectares of the contaminated soil. So there is no scale in the sniffing. So in practice, Zobi was not able to identify the hotspot of the chlorinated phenol contamination. Okay, but there are very many other approaches to do this assessment, and there are all kind of detectors and field measurement devices, and in order to try to do this identification of the source. And then again, in the assessment of the risk, we calculate the significant risk, prioritization of the risk, acceptability of the risk, our resources, what are available. Then we can start to think about the target actions, the most cost-effective effective actions, and compare different options for the control of the risk, for example, by excavation of the soil versus in situ treatment. And this kind of in situ treatment or on-site treatment is something I am working with, and I would like to encourage you to try to introduce this kind of ozonation of Fenton treatment or soil vapor extraction treatment instead of excavation. What is the actual remediation method in the case, what you can find from the MATTI or the data sources of the existing case contamination cases in Finland. And then calculate residual risk, which should be under the acceptable level. And to be sure that the residual concentration doesn't have this kind of rebound effect, what happened actually in Kärkölä after almost 40 years of exposure and continued remediation, then voila, there was a new wave of high concentration of chlorinated phenol coming from the groundwater. This kind of risk assessment is not easy, and there are many different sources of the possible pollutants, and when you do your calculation, you have to really define your target, your area, and try to draw this kind of conceptual models for the compound. And now we are already introducing the endpoint of the risk. Let's say that this is a human being or fish. So this poor receptor can be exposed to the compound X by inhalation and ingestion. Ingestion or by drinking water, or eating some food or ingredients what contains this compound X. And ingestion also indicates that, for example, your contaminant is absorbed on the dust particles, and then you actually your nose will filtrate these particles, and actually it collects the compound X. It doesn't reach the lungs, but you are swallowing the small particles. And then comes this exposure through the skin. Sometimes it can be also very, very important wave of exposure. I try to find examples, but everything what comes to my mind are coming from the occupational exposure scenarios. For example, working with solvents without the proper gloves, or if you are putting, for example, this bitumen on the surface of the road or the roof, and it's a hot summer day, and the workers take the t-shirt off, and the PAH compounds are absorbed to the body, and you are sweating, and in those conditions, this exposure of PAH compounds, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, through the skin into the body is a significant exposure pathway. Then what happens in the body? This goes already quite deep into the toxicology. There are different kind of endpoint of the harmful effects which can be created. This can cause neurotoxic effects like solvents. The endpoint of the exposure is some behavioral or neurotoxic effect. Some compounds are toxic to the liver or kidneys, very many heavy metals, and these radioactive compounds which are in the drinking water. They are very hazardous, not because they are radioactive, but because they go to the kidneys and they are kidney toxic. And then the most serious scenario is the possibility that this compound X causes cancer. And there are two different kind of risk assessment, whether the endpoint is cancer or then this endpoint is some other harmful health effect, but not cancer. And when you do these calculations, there are this average assumption that, for example, in all risk assessment, the consumption of the drinking water is assumed to be 2 liters per day. But think yourself, are you really actually drinking 2 liters of water, of the tap water or well water? So, but this is on the safe side. So probably you are not drinking that much, but it has been decided that we are using this 2 liters per day. But it might happen that there are some compounds in the drinking water, like radon. And when you take shower or wash dishes, the exposure of radon, what is in the drinking water, takes place by the evaporation and transfer of the radon from the water to the gas phase. And in fact, you are exposed by inhalation. And also in the good old times, when the drinking water was done in a way that the water work didn't save chloride. So when I studied the drinking water treatment, I was told that when we start the drinking water treatment, the first thing is to add enough chlorine to the water in order to prevent the growth of the bacteria in the drinking water system. But in Finland, that creates a huge amount of the halogenated organic compound, chlorinated organic compounds, which are very, very toxic and carcinogenic. So sitting in the bath or swimming in the water containing of this kind of water can give you as high concentration and dose of those chlorinated disinfection byproducts besides of the drinking of the water. Then comes inhalation, and inhalation depends on how big you are, how active you are. Are you sleeping, or are you running, or are you exercising? So it depends on that. Ingestion and thermal contact, I told you. And this is the simple way. And when we calculate something, let's say I will give you some calculus, the receptor dose, the intake of compound X for 1 kilo of body weight per day. This is what you need in the risk assessment. And we will concentrate on this drinking water scenario, because concentration of the contaminant in the drinking water, we know it's some 5 milligrams, 15 milligrams, let's say chlorinated phenol per liter. Contact rate, we agreed that let's drink 2 liters per day. How frequently? 365 days per year. Exposure duration. If we are expecting cancer, then we are calculating the whole lifetime. And if it's not cancer, the endpoint is not cancer, then you calculate what is the length of the time when you are exposed to this been drinking of this contaminated water. Body weight, I think it was assumed to be 70 kilos per but of course you can choose whatever. People nowadays tend to be heavier than before, but also on the contrary, if you calculate the intake of let's say the worst case scenario again is the baby, and let's say that this contaminant is coming from the breast milk because the mother has been exposed to dioxins and furans and incineration of hazardous waste, and she has been eating fish coming from the polluted sea, and all those those compounds have concentrated to the fat of the mother, and when the baby is drinking the breastfed milk, the dose of the compound for the baby, perhaps is 2 or 3 kilos, and all the food, the only source of the food is breastfed milk, the exposure is huge. And then the time, average time, depends on again, whether it's for the lifetime or for a moment. These are the standard assumption for the risk calculation, the normal one, and then it might vary. For example, breastfeed milk intake is something up to 1 liter per day for a baby. Fish intake, it varies. Some people don't eat fish at all. Some fishermen are eating fish every day. So that can vary very, very significantly. Inhalation for children, adults, females, males, depends on the activity. And then the soil ingestion rate, please have a look. This is the hot, and this is very, very important place. Children. So children are assumed to eat 100 milligrams of soil every day, or let's be a little bit on safe side, 400 grams of contaminated soil per day. But of course, when we are in Finland, the soil is covered by snow, used to be covered by snow half of the year. And most children don't eat it, but this is the one of the component what has to be included. And included the risk assessment when it takes place in a surrounding of less favored people. Let's say in the middle of the city with the poor people living in the poor conditions, and in those conditions there might be that the child is eating soil or whatever, scratching the walls or something like that. It's up to 10 grams per day, and the life expectancy is 75 years. I think nowadays in Finland it's more than that, and for sure average body weight is more than 72 kilos nowadays. But you can use this one, but you can also choose your own scenario. You can be honest and put your real weight, okay, 90 kilos. So it affects quite significantly the results. And time outdoors, it depends also. Most of adults are outdoors less than 2 hours. And yeah, children seems to be, in USA, they seem to be quite much outdoors per day. But you can change this assumption. And when you do it by yourself, you can play with these scenarios. For example, in in order to make this kind of more sophisticated risk assessment, you can use several assumptions. You can include a very lean persons, medium persons, and then fat people. And these are some pictures my students have sent me pictures when they were children. No problem, you can't recognize them. They don't look like that anymore. But at least he has been eating quite amount of the of the soil. But okay, and the very same. This is a very same formula. Averaging daily dose. And averaging time for the exposure depends on whether your compound X is carcinogenic. You will calculate the probability of the cancer for the lifetime, even though you have been exposed to the carcinogenic compound when you were, let's say, less than 20 years, but you calculate the probability for 75 years. But if you are exposed to non-carcinogenic compound, the averaging time is the time when you are exposed. And if you are talking about acute toxicity, for example, exposed to the drinking of methanol or something like that, then it's immediate. The effect comes immediately. Here I would like to mention this carcinogenic exposure. My professor and my teacher was Terttu Vartiainen for National Public Health Institute, and she made her career. She is the grand lady in the area of drinking water chemistry, and she did dedicate her life for this impurities of the disinfection byproducts formation. And you can guess that the drinking water in Kuopio, where this public health institute of environmental health was located, and she was studying this consumption of the people in Kuopio drinking the water from Kuopio tap water during the time when this very, very brown lake water from Lake Kallavesi was chlorinated heavily. So still there occurs something like 200 extra cancer cases which are caused when the people, the person was consuming the drinking water in Kuopio in 60s, 70s, up to the 80s. And usually with cancer, it takes something like 30 years to show up. So now we are seeing the last cases of the extra cancer cases of urine, bladder, and kidneys, which were caused during the exposure for the drinking of the water in Kuopio 30, 40, 50 years ago. It's very same with asbestos. There was one source of the cancer, very, very rare cancer, mesothelioma, which is caused by asbestos. And asbestos was very common in very many applications until the, let's say, until the 80s. One of the most common occupational cancer source was the exposure of the worker for this asbestos. Now people are aware of this problem, and asbestos has been prohibited for probably for 30 years. And also, if you have asbestos in the building, in the construction, you have to check it, and if you want to do this renovation, you have to hire a special consulting company who can do that under vacuum conditions, because this even one fiber of asbestos can cause a mesothelioma, cancer between stomach and lungs. But of course, the probability is low if you are exposed to the small amount. But if you are really working in the dusty environment full of asbestos, the chance for getting the mesothelioma is very, very high. And then come ingestion, and this is the exposure equation for ingestion via ingestion of food or soil, and please notice here that there's this kind of conversion factor, because some compounds, even they are toxic or carcinogenic, they will go through to the body, absorbed on the soil particle, so they are not actually be released in the body at all. And then comes this if you want to continue this calculation and make it more sophisticated, this is the equation to calculate the contact through the skin. But of course, then you can have a look, for example, the skin surface area for exposure, and also conversion factor, how quickly did this compound goes through the skin. Some solvents, for example, go immediately through the skin. And then comes the inhalation also. And also with inhalation, there are even more uncertainty and possibility to variation. For example, this conversion factor, how much of this compound is absorbed actually your body if you are inhaling it, and most of the some of the toxic compounds are absorbed on the small particles, and it depends on the particle size, how deep into the lungs the particles will penetrate, and whether it goes to the blood or whether it goes to the stomach, it's totally different. Then you have calculated the average daily dose. And if you have energy, you can take all the pathways of exposure and take all the concentration in the air, in drinking water, in soil, so on, and have the added. added value, but in our course we are just calculating the rate with the drinking water, because it gives the idea. And we have at average daily dose the intake of the water, how many milligrams of compound X per kilogram of our body weight per day. And then we go to the data source and we will find slope factors for the carcinogenic risk assessment and reference doses for non-carcinogenic compounds. And sometimes this compound X can be both carcinogenic and non-carcinogenic. And where you can find these values, you can get them from different data sources. IRIS is an American one, I think, but there are also several other ones. And when you do your group work, you take the compound X. You collect the physical and chemical properties of that compounds, whether it's evaporating or whether it's goes, is it soluble to water or is it hydrophobic? And then you take and have a look, what is the toxicity of that compound? And there are different kind of lists where you can get those values. And this is the calculation. If it's like a cancer, if the endpoint is a cancer, it's a chemical specific lifetime average daily dose. So you will calculate the amount of what you have ingested, inhaled, and then for your lifetime, 75 years. And then you can get the slope factor. Or you can get the slope factor from the literature. And then you can get the probability. And then we will talk about what is acceptable probability with cancer. Non-cancer risk assessment is a little bit like easier, because we assume that non-cancer health effects, there is some dose that if you are exposed to small amount of that compound X, there is no hazard dose health effects. It's a safe. And then you can just get this hazard index with this, let's say, no, we will go back to hazard index and whether it's a high or low, is it acceptable or not. And then comes his risk characterization. What is acceptable risk? Let's start with the non-cancer risk. This hazard index with this unitless should be less than one, and preferably much less than one. But then when this carcinogenic risk assessment, the problem is that with the cancer, there is no safe dose. It is assumed that even one radioactive radon molecule might cause you a mutation in the lung cell, or one fiber of asbestos can cause you a mesothelioma. So there is no no safe dose for carcinogenic effect. It is just probability. And then if you start to calculate this risk, the risk of getting cancer exposed to this compound X should be on the range of 10 to minus 4 to 10 to minus 6. And in US, the acceptable risk is 10 to minus 6 per year. And in Europe, the acceptable risk is 10 to minus 5 during the lifetime, which is usually 70, 80 years, which is more or less the acceptable risk is at the same level for the so-called normal people. And acceptable risk for the exposure in the occupational health risk assessment is 10 to minus 4. Because it is assumed that if you are working, and if you are adult, and if you are getting salary, you can take a little bit higher risk because you are paid. And in the calculation of this occupational indoor air condition or condition in the air or exposure, these risks are, these concentrations are higher because of this scenario. But for it's much more sensitive, and the risk is supposed to be much less if you are so-called normal person. But there are always exceptions. And one of the most difficult exception to explain is arsen in drinking water. Because arsen is so common in drinking water in all over the world. In India, Pakistan, Nepal, there are huge amount of the people suffering from skin cancer caused by arsen. But also in Finland, Pirkanmaa area and western part of the Lapland, they're also the concentration of the groundwater with arsen is very high, and people have to drink something. And I think that the acceptable concentration of arsen in drinking water is 10 microgram per liter, and that gives a risk which is 10 to minus 4, and it's very high. But this is based on the reality that people have to drink water, and there are no techniques to remove this arsen. And if you ban the use of the drinking water, it's impossible. So arsen is the exception among the other. All the other drinking water guidelines are based on the risk, cancer risk, 10 to minus 6. And then comes this risk communication, risk perception and risk communication. This is a very, very tricky area. And I think that some of you took this nexus of water, food, and energy, I think. Yes.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And Tom Hatfield was talking about this problem of how the people are perceiving and communicating the risk.
Yes, our three factors.
Yeah, that's the risk. And you remember all those outrage factors, what you can do when you start to talk about this issue. And you did some kind of fact sheet, for example.
Yes.
Where you had to explain to the people that, okay, this is the reality and this is the danger. And you could imagine that now you are, perhaps you are some authority working in the community, and it's your task to talk with the people, local people, that please accept this risk. It's very, very different task. And you notice that, for example, we all know that landfills are necessary. Hazardous incinerators are very, very necessary. Roads are very necessary. Fields are necessary, but not into my backyard. There is so much this sensitivity. Not into my backyard. And today, for example, I was talking with one girl she's doing her bachelor thesis about how the people are considering the dogs in the cities. And there are a lot of people who love to have the dogs there, but then there are people who hate to have the dogs because the dogs are doing peeing and pooing in the parks. They hate the idea. So it depends on if you are a friend of the dogs or if you are against this kind of littering. And this risk communication, I have received several phone calls from concerned fathers of living in the Pirkanmaa area. They have built a nice house somewhere around Tampere. They have a borehole well, and then the local health inspector say that, hey, you have arsen in your drinking water. And poor father is very, very upset that, oh my God, can I drink this water? It's 50 milligrams per liter, or can I do that? And then I start to talk with this father that if you drink this water all your life, 75 years, 2 liters per day, every day, now, then you have a possibility to get a cancer with the probability from 1 to minus 10. Can you take that risk? I ask you, would you practice something with the probability that you might get a cancer with probability in your lifetime 1 from 10,000? Are you willing to do that?
Since life is concerned, it will be difficult.
Should we do the polls? Okay. Now, in the risk, I am a student of Tom Hatfield. I have known him for 30 years. And one of the first thing what he told me, that don't make this mistake, that you are doing the communication of the risk assessment and then you are asked the people to compare the risks. And I have done this. I don't do that. I was giving some evening lecture for one group of the students, and I was asking, what are the biggest health hazards, environmental health hazards? And then they say, okay, it's a nuclear power plants, it's pesticides, okay, it's lead and things like that. And then I said, you know nothing. These are peanuts. I saw that you were smoking outside. You know, if you are smoking, you are getting cancer and you are going to die with 30% probability. Guess what the people did?
They were amazed.
They walked out of the classroom. Don't do that. So, and about, you know, the most risky things are, unfortunately, smoking, drinking alcohol, eating too much fat, getting too much energy. These are the biggest risks. And about after 10 most probable risks come this count, like additives in the foods and pesticide residuals and something like that. But it's very difficult to communicate with the people. Okay. But I think that within the 2 next years there will be a course of it's also internet course given by Tom Hatfield, the risk communication and perception, probably next summer. And this risk characterization, this is difficult. If you are doing this risk-based remediation, what is encouraged nowadays, that don't stick with the PIMA values, PIMA guidelines. Do it by your own variables, your own assumptions, your own cases. Then you should decide all these things by yourself. You should indicate or include all this all these things and describe the risk to the individuals and populations and different stakeholders and then tell them that about the uncertainty that you can get the cancer with the probability of 10 to minus 4. How do you do that? And then turn this risk assessment and decision making to the actual risk management to make the decision that okay, let's start to analyze, let's make the measurements. And let's start to do the remediation. Let's dig the soil out of here and dump it to the landfill or something like that. Let's prevent the drinking of this water or let's build a drinking water treatment filter in order to remove the compounds from the raw water, which is in fact done here in Jyväskylä and also in Tampere. The groundwater, what they are drinking there, is contaminated by pesticides and solvents, which are higher than allowed, but there are treatment plants in order to remove these ingredients from the drinking water. And then it's cheaper than to make the drinking water from the surface water. When I was green, your age, and I was starting to give these courses first time in my life. And after having been doing my doctoral thesis in USA, where all those groundwater sources and all in Europe, where the groundwater is contaminated by pesticides, I was proudly, you know, announcing that in Finland, when we find groundwater contaminated by some contaminant, like in Kärkölä, we automatically close the waterwork and start to drink better water. But little by little, also in Finland, we have found more and more cases where the groundwater is contaminated, but fortunately there are techniques to remove some compound with some technique which is suitable for the removal of that ingredient from the drinking water. If it's radon, let's aerate it. if it's a chlorinated solvent, let's build this kind of a tower for aeration stripping of the compound. If it's non-water soluble, let's put the activated carbon filter and that compound is removed. And that's it. Very, very common nowadays. Also in Finland. Oh, yeah. And yeah, guideline values for contaminated soil. As I told, if you use based on the worst case scenario, that is very high. Use probably is much less. Then the ecotoxicological based value can be much, much lower than health based value. But anyway, then we have produced the risk-based remediation goals by ourselves. We have been calculating the risk, and we have been discussing with the decision makers and local people that shall we accept this risk, and then we fix that. Let's leave this soil there. The risk is not so high, because if we take this PIMA values, sometimes it's very difficult to reach them, those with the reasonable price. But on the contrary, think about yourself. If you are authority making the decision about remediation, would you prefer to calculate the risk by yourself, or would you like to take this nice green PIMA book and take the accepted, commonly used value from this Bible, PIMA guideline value decree of the government appendix? Which one you prefer?
Maybe calculate it yourself.
You calculate yourself, you said.
Yeah, yes.
I think most of the people prefer to take this green book. And if you go to read the green book written by Jussi Ristimäki, you can see all this calculation, what is based on this technique, and you can get all these values from there. But they has been produced by all these authorities, and Jussi Reinikainen has collected and made this nice book. So, yeah. And then you can calculate backwards. You take the acceptable risk, and then you start to calculate backwards, and then you can get concentration in your hypothetical media, and then you can select whether you take it, or then you take the guideline level, upper or lower guideline level coming from the PIMA document. Okay, and if you are interested about this how these are produced, there is a book in Finnish, but I'm sure that it can be also find in internet. And also this my favorite book, La Greca Wastewater Engineering, it contains the principle of this more sophisticated calculation of the risk. And if you want to study more, we have been practicing this calculation backwards. And sometimes the environment is not the soil. In our case, it was the walls and the PCB in the walls. And we did the calculation backwards, and you can go to this article and what we did, we used this uncertainty factors and variability of different kind of scenario and distribution of the drinking water intake, for example. This is the very simple example that it varies. But then there are also some other things. And if you want to have a conservative value, you take the one assumption. But if you want to compare the risk with different kind of scenarios, then you can get the real risk. And so source of uncertainty, unfortunately, I don't have this article here, but I will put it in the Moodle, because it gives you a risk, what is the worst case scenario risk, and then the real risk and most probable risk is much, much, much smaller than that if you take the realistic assumption. But okay, I think the time is out now, and this was the basics of environmental risk assessment, health-based and environmental risk assessment, little bit combined to the soil remediation, but on environmental remediation. But on Friday, we will take the same thing, but we will start from the practical, from the different angle. But we are discussing the very same thing, but this is the background of the risk-based remediation goals or calculating the risks. Okay.